Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mehler here, and we're going to start with a real sweet conversation. We're going to talk about the science of ice cream on the show today. I'm going to have a chance to take a bite or two from some ice creams. Compliments of our guest, Scott Rankin, back with us, professor of food science, chairs the Department of Food Science at the UW-Madison. It's always a treat in many ways to have him on the show to talk about ice cream. And I hope you'll join in. Do you make your own ice cream ever? Any special ingredients or tools you want to know about the science behind ice cream? Give us a call. Number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. Scott Rankin, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. Thanks so much for the invitation. It's always a treat to be here and visit with you.
Well, it's always a lot of fun for me, and I've got to talk about your department in food science. Within food science, you have a group, yourself and a few other people, that probably know everything there is to know about ice cream and actually frozen desserts in general, right?
That's right, yeah. So our department, so I'm representing and have been a member of the Department of Food Science in the College of Ag and Life Sciences here on the UW campus. And within our department, several years ago, one of my colleagues, Rich Hartel, and a few others, decided to sort of put together a program focused on frozen desserts to bring some focus and some design, some strategies to doing research and outreach in frozen desserts. So it's called, you know, Frozen Dessert Center, not super creative name, but it speaks to what we do. And we work with all things frozen desserts, so not just ice cream. So there are permutations on that that include things like popsicles and frozen ices and gelato, custard, and so on and so forth. And the principle behind it, though, is that from an either engineering or a structural standpoint, frozen desserts are extremely complicated foods. And while it's, we might think, well, you know, vanilla ice cream, pretty achievable product, right? But that's true. But when we start thinking about things like low fat or low sugar, or we want it to last longer, or maybe some ingredients are really expensive and we need to alter the formulation and so forth, that's where an understanding of the science of frozen desserts really comes into play. So,
yeah, and there's and we should talk about all those things. Ice cream. What's the most common ingredient in ice cream? I assume it's milk.
Yeah, well, it depends what sort of units you use, really.
Okay.
If you look at it from a mass standpoint, most what we would call so standard frozen desserts, from a volume standpoint, it's a lot of air, you know. So we whip air into ice cream, and that's part of its, in fact, part of its definition is how much air we can entrain into a frozen dessert product. Certainly a lot of water, milk fat, milk solids, different flavor systems. Amongst the solids, the highest component is really lactose. So So ice cream takes milk and it enriches the milk, so it concentrates it. And the biggest component of milk next to water is lactose. So ice cream has a lot of lactose in it. So those are the key things that really dictate its performance. Anytime you concentrate milk, we always talk about milk as like, does the body good? And we soon get into discussion about calcium. Well, ice cream has a lot of calcium in it too, because again, it's enriched or concentrated milk. So a lot of minerals in ice cream.
So what makes, there's ice cream and then there's ice cream.
right.
You know, that rich mouthfeel and just something really sweet and you want to keep going with it.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, I mean, you know, in the profile of foods we eat, we eat for different reasons, right? So we might eat, I just turned 60 this year. Maybe oatmeal is more prominent in my diet than it was when I was a teenager. So we eat for sustenance, right? We also eat for fun and enjoyment and celebration and things like that. And in terms of what makes really good ice cream, what separates maybe the what we might refer to as an economy brand ice cream for something that's really sophisticated and really impresses everyone. You could maybe draw a comparison to wines. There are some that, mm-hmm. you know, you can buy at a gallons of it, and others that are, you know, a 20-year-old, you know, aged wine and so forth. So ice cream, the really premium ice creams are defined by a handful of things. One is that they have typically more milk fat than what you'd typically, you know, the standard ice cream. So milk fat ranging between maybe 16 to 18% milk fat. So that's a lot of milk fat.
Yeah.
And that gives it a really creamy character, real creamy flavor. Typically in really premium ice creams, they don't entrain much air in them. So if you go to the supermarket and you see a pint of ice cream that's really expensive and versus something that's maybe less expensive, I'd encourage your viewers to like lift them, you know, just because one is very, typically it's very dense. So they don't entrain much air into it. So it's very, again, it's a very dense product. And the other thing is the character of the flavor systems. And so we'll taste some flavors here in a little bit, but even in the world of vanilla, you know, vanilla comes from all different places, typically equatorial-based countries and so forth. But how it's made, how it's extracted, how it's presented and so forth can also... So again, that's another character of really good systems, is they use very good flavor systems. And the background of that, they're using extremely high-quality dairy ingredients. So these are products that are, you know, fresh and that are manufactured just in preparation for freezing.
And that 16% milk fat, that would, or 18, that's really getting up there. And mostly they wouldn't go higher than that, would they?
You're right. So 16, 18%, it's pretty rich. You know, if you're going
to, yes.
You know, I don't drink alcohol, but I know the term sipping whiskey, right? I think it's a really high quality whiskey that you might just sip a little bit and enjoy its character and so forth. And you wouldn't sit down and drink a pint of it or, you know, just at one sitting. So similarly with these really sophisticated ice creams, they're designed to be really enjoyed. And maybe you're not going to consume, you know, a half gallon or something while you're watching the 6 o'clock news and so forth. So.
Well, yeah, and I read somewhere where ice cream makers, if you made it too rich, then people don't eat as much.
Right,
so you're not selling as much.
Well, as that milk fat content goes up, certainly the price goes up. The other thing about milk fat is most of the flavor systems have a preferential binding to the milk fat. So if I made an ice cream with low milk fat and of ice cream of high milk fat and put the same amount of vanilla in them, the vanilla would be perceived to be more prominent in the low milk fat product.
Huh.
Because the fat absorbs a lot of the chemistry, if you will, the components of a vanilla extract. And so if you talk to a vanilla manufacturer, they're always encouraging high milk fat products because you know, you have to use more vanilla in order of their product, right? So they can be a little muted, if you will, if you're not designed properly. But I'd encourage, you know, if your listeners are interested in looking at really good products and trying to differentiate them a little bit, I would encourage them to become an expert on vanilla ice cream because it's hard to hide. It's hard to hide anything in vanilla, right? So you find the vanillas that are really, really good. It'll sort of set a standard in your mind for like all the other products and flavors that you might enjoy.
Mark in Wisconsin Dells has a question or comment. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to mention that one of my favorite ice creams is sweet corn ice cream that I learned to make from a university colleague who had spent time in Brazil, where apparently sweet corn ice cream is pretty popular, and it is really good. You make it like a fruit ice cream. Now, I heard a rumor that Quick Trip was going to put it in their shelves soon, probably at the time when they start to release the cranberry pizza, which I think is really good also.
Cranberry pizza? Is that
what cranberry pizza, well, Mark said.
Well, sweet corn ice cream. So one of the programs we offer is called the Batch Freezer Course, and that's designed to attract people who are, they might have a business model. They might have read the history of Ben and Jerry's, and they want to follow that path. So they're trying to make a small scale manufacturing facility and make really novel products. And so people come to this course to learn how to make them. And we've made sweet corn product, and if you like sweet corn, and the other thing that you can do with sweet corn ice cream is you can you can, instead of using just milk fat, you can use ghee or brown butter, which mimics, you know, a buttered ice cob of corn. And so, well, I'll stop there. Just let those flavors sort of percolate out there. But it's really, really good. If you like sweet corn, buttered sweet corn, you can also add a little bit of salt to it, which also, you know, there are many savory ice creams, in fact. So the salty caramel and so forth. So there are very few flavor systems for which ice cream does not work well. So, so sweet corn's an excellent product.
Mark, thanks thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Rankin, our guest, professor of food science and chair of the Department of Food Science at UW-Madison, talking ice cream with him. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News, talking ice cream today with Scott Rankin. A little bit later on, we'll talk about preserving your family heirlooms. But right now, Mom told me, always told me, don't talk with your mouth full. And I just had a mouthful of this delicious ice cream from Babcock Dairy, of course. And it's lactose-free vanilla. And it's delicious.
No, thanks. Thanks. And that's, you know, Babcock Dairy is a very unique facility here on campus. My colleague Casey White and his staff manufacture a host of different flavors. And a few years ago, we decided to try to enter into the lactose-free space. And there are a lot of advantages to it. Lactose, as I mentioned earlier, it's the biggest component of typical milks next to water. But it doesn't have a great value for us in many ways. So many people avoid it because of lactose intolerance. It does present us, you know, 4 grams for calories per gram. And it's not very sweet. It alters the freezing point. It can become insoluble in the ice cream and cause another defect. So making lactose-free ice cream actually makes a lot of sense. So we're just, it's just like an experiment that we can just sort of present here on campus. So.
Well, it is really, really good. And here I am talking with my mouth full again. Let's go to Kathy in Middleton while I sip away here on some ice cream. Go ahead, Kathy.
Good morning. I am not the largest consumer of ice cream, but when I want it, I want it. So I go to the grocery store and I find whatever I can find that hopefully fits my needs. I like my ice cream hard. I don't like soft serve. I don't like the stuff that just kind of melts when you put it in the bowl. I want it hard and hopefully from the grocery store, where it's readily available at 10 p.m. if I choose to go there. Any recommendations, suggestions? What should I look for?
Oh, that's a great, great question. And you know, I applaud your position of, you know, liking hard ice cream. So, and in general, the harder it is, the longer it's going to last. So think of shelf life of foods. The main driver in the shelf life of ice cream is development of ice crystals, and the harder it is, that typically indicates something about the initial freezing point and its freezing point depression curve. So again, hard ice creams, excellent. And in fact, the language of ice cream, of frozen desserts in general, we call what Larry's eating here, we call that hard pack ice cream because it's designed to be manufactured and then frozen really hard. So it's manufactured about 20 Fahrenheit and frozen to like negative 30. So it's very hard. And that's where we can get 18-month storage. And then there's soft serve. So hard pack, soft serve. And of course, soft serve is what you'd encounter at maybe Culver's stands and certainly soft serve at restaurants and so forth. So your question was really about, well, so some recommendations. And I'm going to share a recent Father's Day event we had. My daughter, Madeline, she bought a bunch of ice creams, pints, ice creams, and we had a kind of a Father's Day dinner table, so to speak, with her family and kids. And we had a little competition of deciding or trying to determine the flavors of the ice cream. And it was just really fun. And we got to look at a lot of different ice creams. So I'd encourage you to you know, it's like music. Like the more you know about all kinds of music, I think the better you appreciate any music. So know what's good, know what's bad, know what's of value, know what's expensive and why it is, and appreciate the colors, the flavors. So again, there's a lot to learn about ice cream, and I encourage you to think broadly about all the different frozen desserts you might encounter.
Kathy, thanks again. I've now opened and have chomped down, not chomped, orange custard chocolate chip, which is another delicious. And these are, you know, Babcock Dairy. So Babcock, by the way, dairy has quite a nice reputation.
No, it does. And part of it is based on some traditional products, some products that we've been around for longer than I have, and the formulations are just appreciated by alumni and family and friends and so forth that come to campus. Orange custard chocolate chip is one of them, and I feel like every time I say that, I should pause for effect, you know, because it's some people love it. People
oh,
just
so good.
They come here for you know, far away just to have our, but it is a custard, and a custard ice cream contains a small portion of egg yolk solids, and what egg yolk solids do is they alter the fat structure in when ice cream is being made, and they make it taste more creamy, so more smooth and soft and so forth. So that's custard. So custard stands, custard ice creams and so forth, they contain a small amount of egg yolks that makes them, again, taste a little more creamier than a typical ice cream would.
An email, the Italians don't like to mix acid ingredients like lemon with dairy. What are your thoughts on that?
No, it's a good question. So we make ice cream at home, and the Sunday we had lime. My wife Teresa made lime ice cream, so a citrusy flavor in ice cream. And the reason it's maybe frowned upon is the wrong word, but it's functionally challenging to add acidic products to dairy. Ice cream that has protein in it, because milk proteins are very susceptible to denaturation as the pH starts to drop. So if we add something very acidic to milk, you know, you're going to have cottage cheese kind of a thing pretty soon.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge with it. We make some products like a key lime pie. Beck key lime pie, in fact, is one of our flavors, and does contain some flavor systems, but you need to be very careful about what levels you add, because as the pH starts to drop, then it starts to get curd. In fact, it becomes very curdy, and that's kind of an unpleasant mouthfeel. So that's what Italians and others really are concerned with, is the development of those sort of the curd-like character in acidic ice cream products.
You've brought along a chocolate peanut butter. Which I haven't gotten into yet, but I'm about to. So tell me about that so I can have a bite.
Yeah, well, this sort of speaks to the idea that ice cream is one of those few products that can take a lot of different forms. So this product is chocolate ice cream base, but it has peanut butter in it, and it has some what we call inclusions or bits and pieces of ice of chocolate in it. And so it's visually, it's very pretty looking.
Oh,
you know,
it is.
Flavor-wise,
really tasty.
It's a lot of character to it. And then mouthfeel, the inclusions provide a unique character to it. And typically, inclusions for ice cream are made specifically for frozen desserts. So the chocolate and ice creams would perform very different than just a Hershey bar you might buy off the supermarket store.
Yeah, that makes sense. And another, you have something called Union Utopia.
Right, that's another one of our hallmark products, and again, very, very popular, and so sold at the Union outlets, and again, just appreciated by, students here on campus, you know, they're stressed out, right? Like, there's finals week, or, you know, money issues, or significant, whatever. It's a little stressful time, as was mine when I was in college. And ice cream can help. You know, it provides a source of enjoyment. And so products like Union Utopia are those that have been around for a long time. So as alumni come back, they really have a unique experience having it again. So it's very heartwarming to see.
And Badger Blast.
Yeah, now this one's a little bit of a mystery, so maybe you can explain it to us, Larry. What is it?
Well, it looks chocolatey.
Yeah.
And there are chocolate chunks in there.
Yeah. So it's again, it's a product that we make for, we call it kind of an indulgent ice cream. So where, again, the colors, the flavors, the textures are very pleasing and memorable. And so it creates a really potent memory as you have these products. So so Badger Blast is in that category of ice creams that people, you know, can come to love. So.
Really good. What's how long have people been making ice cream? How far back does it go?
Oh, quite a ways. I think the it's kind of difficult to really nail down, but the thought is that in ancient Rome, they would send runners up into the mountains to gather snow, and they'd bring them down and use the snow for various purposes, including making a frozen dessert with things like honey and fruits and so forth, and almost more of a frozen ice than ice cream per se. But that's where it kind of started, I think. There's another rationale that suggests that the Chinese, in fact, had a similar sort of practice of bringing down snow to the more populated, warmer areas and enjoying an ice-based, you know, dessert type of a product.
How much ice cream do we can? Well, you're visiting with someone here who lives within 5 minutes of two ice cream shops. I'm probably raising the consumption level up the average amount, but we know how much people actually consume.
Yeah, so it's right around so per capita consumption in the U.S. is right around 20 gallons, and 20 gallons per year, and so that's maybe declining a little bit because in that frozen dessert category there's a lot more than ice cream now. So it's a lot of plant-based products and frozen ices and other things that don't quite fit in the quote-unquote ice cream category, but we still find it enjoyable. It's still certainly in the summer months, it's still enjoyable product that is widely enjoyed by a large swath of not only the U.S. but across the world.
Certainly by me, and I got to taste every single one, all five.
That's great. Scott, that's great,
Scott. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And next time we'll have you on for even longer, and we'll talk more about ice cream.
Sounds good. We'll work on some new flavors for you, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott Rankin, professor of food science, chair of the Department of Food Science at the University of Wisconsin, and they have, and from their Frozen Dessert Center on the UW-Madison campus, and it is the premier department for ice cream and frozen desserts, I would think, in the world. I doubt that there's anyone that would argue with me either. It's great to have him with us. We'll have him back, but we're going to turn our attention to preserving your family heirlooms. Do you have something you want to save? Maybe it's a tape. Maybe it's an old spoon from great-great-grandma. We'll talk about that next. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and I want you to think about an object in your home that holds special meaning. Maybe it's your grandma's handwritten recipe, or maybe it's a videotape of your children. I bet you want to keep those items for as long as possible and pass down these memories to other members of your family. We're talking about how to take care of family heirlooms. Maybe old quilts, maybe photographs, maybe letters, and a whole lot more. And here to help us by phone, Kat Latham. Kat is Director of Collections, Information, and Management for the Wisconsin Historical Society. And as we talk with Kat, I hope you'll join in. Tell us how you take care of your family heirlooms. Where's the best place to store an old wedding dress or maybe a quilt? Walk us through your process for maybe digitizing old photos and videos. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Kat Latham, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell us what you do. I'll begin by saying the Wisconsin Historical Society has so many cool things going on. And Here you are, Director of Collections Information and Management at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Tell us what you do as director.
Lots of things. I currently oversee the team that does our what we call descriptive work for collections, so the catalog records for books and archival collections, the metadata, the online descriptions you see of our images, our photos, and my past role included overseeing the conservation lab and our preservation here at the Historical Society. So I've worked with many different aspects of collections. And like you said, we've got so many cool things going on. So we're working on like how we connect our website with our new history center and how we're doing new descriptive work online. It's so exciting right now to be a part of the Historical Society.
It's got to be. What did you study in order to have this profession?
I actually have a bachelor's degree in public history and archaeology, and a master's degree in public history. So I've spent pretty much most of my time knowing that I wanted to work in a museum. I literally told my family that even if I had to be the security guard or the janitor, this is what I was going to do.
Well, you know, I've got a few things. I've got a sugar cup that my mother got from her grandmother, and I put it away. I've got it up out. I don't use it, and I've often thought about, shouldn't I just be using this? And if you've got some old stuff at home, photos, letters, baby blankets, should you be afraid to use them in fear of breaking them?
So the thing about like family heirlooms is that the value of them really has a lot to do with like the connection you have to them. And I always, even in a museum or a history center, I always say that like preserving them should really be balanced with like use and enjoyment. So there are certain things you don't want to use to completely use up, but things like your sugar dish, it's pretty stable. I have mine that my mom got me when I graduated high school and I was headed off to college. She bought me a little teacup ceramic set, and at first I was like, oh, I should keep this forever, but I use it and I like to use it. I would definitely recommend that you think about balancing out how you enjoy things. So, like, bring out those scrapbooks. Occasionally, you know, read those old letters and use your sugar dish. I think that's how you build connection and ongoing connection with those things.
I know you've got some basic steps to kind of help people make their treasures last. I imagine one would be sunlight and avoiding it, direct or bright light at least.
Yeah, there's some basic like rules of thumb to keeping things like for a long period of time. And, you know, that, like I said, balancing that use and enjoyment, but also like, you know, when you're not using your sugar dish, make sure that it's kind of away from direct sunlight. Sunlight, I mean, we need it to survive, but it is going to fade any decorations. It fades paint, it fades ink, so avoid that. You want to try to keep your temperatures as consistent as possible. Big swings in humidity or big swings in temperature, they tend to really affect, like, particularly clothing and photographs. Paper. You want to try to keep things clean. So like the outside of your sugar dish, make sure you're like keeping it from getting dusty. And partially because like it'll over time, it's going to really stick and be much harder to clean off. So if you want to make sure you keep that clean, every time you run out of sugar, let it run all completely out. Run it under some warm water and keep it clean so that it doesn't get all sticky. And you don't want it sticky, not only because the longer it's sticky, the harder it is to clean, but you want to protect it from insects and keep pests away. So those things can really damage more like easily damage, like you don't want moths in your clothes. So make sure you avoid some pests. Like sunlight, prolonged exposure to moisture is, and even temporary for some things, moisture is just, it's a killer.
Yeah, I'm this whole business about storing, though, you know, I have, because we're selling some family family home that was been in the family for, I don't know, forever. Basically, there are large tubs. There are five large tubs that are filled with photos.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm sitting here, where am I going to put these? And store them. I have a plan. I have a plan because there's going to be some family get together, and they're going to be pulled out, and people are going to be able to go through them and pick the ones they would like and want to keep, and we're going to kind of do it that way. But storing something like that or anything.
Yeah, honestly, the thing that you said about going through them and sort of having family pick them, I love that so much because it allows, again, that connection that you have with your heirlooms, and I think that's really important. But storage is like, especially if you've got tubs and tubs, I always say to try to avoid plastic tubs or like things that are completely airtight for storage because air circulation really is, it's really important for things like paper and photographs. Also those kind of plastic tubs, like the emulsion layer, if it gets moisture at all, can like stick, your photographs can stick together inside there or stick to the tubs. So I try to recommend for photographs, things like very inexpensive options. You've got like a shoebox, a literal shoebox, paper, like a paper box is always going to be better than plastic. You want to look for something that's as pH neutral as possible. So you could get some archival made boxes, some good places you can order like online from companies like Gaylord Brothers or Hollinger Metal Edge. But also, those are really expensive, which is why I also say, hey, your shoebox is actually like a paper box in your closet is actually better than a plastic box.
Wow. Kat Latham, our guest today, Director of Collections, Information, and Management for the Wisconsin Historical Society. And we're talking about how to care for and preserve family keepsakes. Questions for her? Or maybe an experience to share of your own. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. And a quick mention that noon today we'll talk about the history of Door County cherries, and we'll get some suggestions for what you'd like to hear on the show as well at about 12:30. So lots going on, but right now we're zeroing in on taking care of those family heirlooms, and it's kind of fun talking about them. Clothes. What about clothing?
Yeah.
Old clothes. You put them in the washing machine?
I don't.
Well, should I be doing it?
the longer you want to keep things nice, the less you want to expose them to the kind of like twists and pulls of a washing machine. So hand washing, if it depending on the fabric, is going to be better than your washing machine. try not to twist it, try not to wring it, try not to stretch it. So I think earlier I had said, you know, like keep your items clean, but always make sure you're cleaning them as gently as possible. You always want to make sure that you're not using like really tough cleansers, whether that's in your clothes or any other thing. But I generally recommend that if you can dry clean something, that you dry clean it. I tend to recommend if you want to store something very long term, like a wedding dress. Earlier, one of my friends actually asked me like how to preserve her wedding dress. You want to try if you possible, again, thinking about what's possible versus what's best, laying it flat in a big acid-free box is usually going to be the best way to keep it from really getting some wear and tear and having stretching going on. But you can hang it in a clothes bag, a fabric clothes bag, preferably in the back of your closet. You want to do this in a closet in a human occupied area of your house. So don't put it in your attic. Don't put it in your basement, because those places have big swings in temperature and big swings in humidity. So you want to keep that plate in some place that is like not experiencing big swings in humidity and in temperature. So the back of your closet you use every day, because you tend to keep the spaces you use every day pretty steady.
That makes a lot of sense. Although as you were talking, I was thinking about finding a hole in a sweater that I think was eaten up by a cricket or something. This is years ago. I don't have any crickets in my house right now, I don't think, at least. But the insects and the pests can be a problem, maybe if they're in the back of a of a wardrobe.
Yeah, I mean, so you really do. Pests are a really big problem. I would bet that in pretty much every person's house, they have carpet beetles. Carpet beetles are going to eat your clothes too. They don't just eat carpet. So those kinds of things can be a problem. I personally, I hate the smell of mothballs, but they do serve a purpose. I prefer to go with, like, there are cedar block things that are pest, they keep pests away. Cedar, if you've got a cedar chest in your house, it is a great place to store things, because cedar tends to keep pests away. It's not perfect. It's not going to be the, like, one thing. It certainly isn't going to kill all the pests. It tends to just keep them away. Pests tend to not really like cedar. So if you got a cedar chest and you want to put some stuff in it that you want to preserve for a long time, that's at home. That's a pretty decent way of doing that. I do always caution against too many folds. The more you fold something, that creates a lot of pressure on the fibers in clothing or even quilts. Those kinds of folds can be long-term. They can also create a lot of tension in clothing. They also, if you fold something, a pest is going to go in that fold. He's going to find a haven there.
Oh, my goodness. Jerry in La Crosse has a question. Let's go there. Jerry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a large quantity, say 70,000 pictures on my computer that are from all over the world, and I'd like to keep them. How would I do that? Well, one thing is, how do I organize them and how do I keep them? You know, you might have some from England and some from Laos and some from Africa, and you want them all kind of categorized.
Oh, yeah, those are good questions. I've been talking about preserving physical stuff, but preserving digital photos. Um, I I tend to recommend having more than one copy of a photograph, so digital photographs, digital files, and hard drive, an external hard drive from your computer can be really useful, as can a cloud storage option. We here at the Historical Society actually tend to utilize both. Some stuff is in some cloud storage. Some of it actually is still on external hard drives. So making sure that you've got a backup in your cloud storage that's like your master copy. So you just leave it in there. The other thing, as far as organizing, that there isn't like a generally quick and easy way to just organize all of your off photos. It is time consuming and it takes a lot of human work. I generally recommend that you do it as you go. So when you come back from whatever trip, you create a folder in the cloud that says London. You put all those photographs in there. You dedicate some time shortly after that to create a spreadsheet that gives each one of the file names and its caption as to what it is going to be the best way to do it personally. Unless you want to invest in like a digital asset management system, which are really expensive. Most individual people aren't doing that. But if you're just looking for yourself a spreadsheet that gives, the file name and give it a caption and put it in that folder is going to be your best bet for organizing.
Yeah. Thinking about a friend of mine, four of us played golf in Scotland last year, and we all took our digital photos, and then one of the guys said, well, send me your photos, and everybody sort of sent him the photos, their photos, and then he took the photos, and so he had them digitally, but then he also printed off many of the photos and made a scrapbook and then put some other things, things that material things that we may have, napkins or whatever that we may have had, and put together the greatest scrapbook. And it's so much fun to actually look at the photos themselves.
Yeah, I love it. So I have a love-hate relationship with scrapbooks. I love that they're so personal and you can do so many things with them. But a lot of the things that are made, like the way you make a scrapbook, it includes adhesives and it includes sticky stuff and so many different types, a napkin next to a photograph. Wow, it's a lot. So I tend to recommend that when you make a scrapbook like that, that you are getting some acid-free paper. You could usually get it at Staples or an office supply store, and you just kind of interleave between the pages that acid-free paper. It keeps things from any of the adhesives from like touching the other side of the page. If you've got inks in there, keeps inks from bleeding onto other pages, and it just really helps to keep things like in place for a longer period of time. And also to try to buy a box to put it in. Where it sits fairly snugly. You don't want things like a scrapbook to be like jostling around inside your box, because that just damages like the binding and it damages the corners. And the longer you can keep that scrapbook together in one piece, the longer each thing inside of it's going to last.
Well, talking about photos, but it also reminds me about VHS tapes, for example, or CDs. talk us through how to make the decision to digitize something like that.
So a lot of your, actually a lot of the decisions that you make regarding how you're going to keep things and how long you're going to keep them really have to do with what it is that's important about the thing for you. Significantly, for example, when I was growing up, we collected as many of the first edition Disney VHS cassette tapes we could. And they have a value to me because my mom and I used to really hunt for these things. I'm going to keep those VHS tapes in their box and as they are, because they're a three-dimensional artifact that has meaning as an artifact. But if you have home videos, things that you've like recorded from your family over the years, I actually always recommend people get those digitized rather than trying to keep the original medium 100% always workable and watchable. So if you think of your original medium, again, I said, as like that master copy, and your digitization or your digitized version as the thing you can like watch and boot up every year on your TV for your family to enjoy. So if you're looking at what's important to me is the content and being able to enjoy what's on the VHS, digitize that, because you don't want to watch your VHS over and over again. audio cassette tapes as well. Like if you've got some cassette tapes, they're pretty stable. They'll stay pretty stable for a long time. But the second you put them in that cassette player, you risk that like your tape's going to get fed up in there. And if you're a child of the 80s or 90s, you remember getting out your pencil and having to fix your cassette tape. Don't use it unless you are willing to risk that it will not make it through the use.
Or if the tape breaks.
Exactly. Then you're out. It's really hard. It's a lot more expensive to get a tape digitized once it breaks.
And I do like your idea. I also had a friend who we have get together every year and did it for like 20 years in a row. And he took a piece, and he always had some film of it, and he pieced together like the 20 years. And it was fun to see people's weight go up and down, their hairlines recede, their clothing changes. And really a lot of fun to sit down and watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And you want to be able to watch that for a really long time. Like that's the best part. That's why we keep our family treasures, right? So we can just have those enjoyments.
Yeah, I think it's I think you gain a lot from experiencing history, not only in video, but in a, sort of a tactile material way, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. There is nothing like being so close that you can touch the history, or you can even be a part of whatever it is and interact with it in very cool ways. So I'm going to give one little plug for upcoming History Center, which we're opening in a couple of years. Right now, our Wienermobile from the 60s is going to be in the History Center, and you can climb in it, and you can sit behind the wheel, and you can take your picture of you driving the Wienermobile.
You know,
and that is just so great.
Several of my former students actually wound up as drivers for the Wienermobile. I can't wait to try that out. Kat, thanks. Hey, it's been a lot of fun, and I hope we can do this again. Thank you so much for spending your time with us today. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I had a lot of fun.
Kat Latham is Director of Collections, Information, and Management for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Coming up, we're going to talk about Door County cherries. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Sing along, Red Tree. berries all day long. Pick them, eat them, share with friends. The sweet cherry fun never
ends.
Oh,
yeah. Pick them, eat them, share them with friends. Cherries. And, you know, when you think about cherries in Wisconsin, your attention probably goes directly to Door County. I think Door County is kind of the center of cherry production in our state. And we'll talk about the history of cherries in Door County now with our guest, Amy Frank. She is executive director of the Door County Historical Society. So we'll talk history of the cherry industry in that in our state with Amy. And, of course, want to hear from you. Tell us about the time you visited Door County and saw, maybe picked some cherries, or maybe you've grown your own cherries. What's your advice for getting the best, juiciest crop? What do you think of cherry bombs? Have you had a cherry bomb? Well, we can talk about cherry bombs. We can talk about dynamite, too. Because dynamite played a role in the history of cherries in Door County. And I'm pretty sure Amy has a little information on that. I know I did some research myself on it. You can call in. Anyway, the number is 800-642-1234. You enjoy Door County and the cherry season? I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Amy Frank, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me here.
How'd you get to be director of the Door County Historical Society?
You know, it was a lot of luck, and it's one of the best jobs in the world. I'm having a great time being their executive director, and every day in Door County is a beautiful day.
Yeah, it is. Do you have to? Are you a fundraiser type, or are you a director type without having to do that?
Oh no, fundraising is definitely part of the job. I don't know many nonprofit managers that get away with not doing fundraising.
I think you're probably right there. Well, let's talk cherries here for just a minute. What kind?
Sure.
What kinds of cherries are grown in Door County?
95% of the cherries that are grown here are the Montmorency cherries, the tart cherries that can be used in pies and in jams and all kinds of other foods.
And, you know, just thinking about it, the climate, why is the climate in Door County so good for growing cherries?
Well, there are a number of reasons why fruit grows particularly well here in Door County. One of them is the, like you said, the climate, the weather. Because we are surrounded by water here with Green Bay on one side and Lake Michigan on the other side, that kind of temperates our climate a little bit. So we don't have such harsh conditions. And we have a little bit longer spring without some of the hard frost that would be detrimental to fruit crops. And then the other reason that Door County is so well suited to growing fruit trees and cherries in particular is due to the soil. So the soil here, because we're on the Niagara Escarpment, is very rocky. And there are areas where there's very little topsoil, which made farming, you know, really difficult for those early settlers that came here in the late 1800s. But it works well for fruit trees because they need their roots need to be shallow, but the rocky soil allows for drainage. So then those roots, you know, don't sit in water and rot. There's plenty of drainage for the trees to thrive and grow.
Yeah, I think I was reading somewhere the apple. I guess the original history is somebody had apple trees, and then somebody else thought, well, why not cherries?
Yes, exactly. So Joseph Zettel was a Swiss immigrant in the mid-1800s who came here and discovered that apples did well, and he had quite a large apple orchard. And then that attracted the attention of some other folks from the southern part of the state and a horticulturist from the University of Wisconsin. And they came up to Door County and tried their hand at growing a bunch of different varieties of fruit and plums, strawberries, raspberries, and what they determined was cherries really thrived in this environment.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And it started kind of small, but how did it grow? There were a lot of farms at one point.
There were, around the turn of the century, farmers learned that this was a really good source of additional income for them. Farming in Door County, as you can imagine, just based on the soil conditions, was very difficult and hard work. And they were kind of just living to sustain themselves. And when they discovered that they could add some cherry trees on their farm and sell those cherries to in road stands and to passerbys, that was an additional source of income for them. And it really just took off from there.
At one point, there were like 700, I think, cherry farms. Yes. In Door County.
At one point, there were 700 growers here. This was in the 40s and the 50s. 700 growers worked 10,000 acres of cherry orchards, and they produced 50 million pounds of cherries annually. And that contributed to 10% of the world's cherries. So Door County was the spot for to get your cherries from.
And how did it gain? Door County had a national reputation. How did that happen?
It happened because they just by sheer volume of the cherries that were being produced out of the county in the 40s. They also started doing canning of cherries as well. Cherry growing and harvesting is a very short window of time. And so once they learned how to can the cherries, then the production just boomed.
Yeah, the history of that cannery I thought was really cool. It was a pea vine cannery, wasn't it?
It was. Yep. And Mr. Reynolds had that pea canning company and turned it into a cherry canning facility and was very successful.
Yeah, that was back in 1919, somewhere in there, if mm-hmm. I'm not mistaken. He actually was brought home from World War One.
Yes.
To run the place.
Right, because his father had passed away, and so they brought him home from the war to run the facility.
Yeah, and of course, this really helped the industry, because then you could obviously you can those cherries, because it was impossible. I mean, back in those days, transportation and all that and getting the cherries when they're ripe to the people.
Yeah, it's a very short life. And so unfortunately, a lot of the crops just spoiled because they couldn't get to people in time until they developed these other techniques of preserving them. Yeah. But Mr. Reynolds was quite the entrepreneur and marketer. So he saw kind of the opportunity here with cherries, and he created a cherry blossom festival, a cherry festival in the 50s that drew huge crowds to the area. And as you can imagine, all kinds of things related to cherries, cherry pie contests, and parades and cherries everywhere. So that really allowed Door County, or created the notion that Door County was the cherry capital of the world.
I thought that was pretty cool. And I think there still is one, isn't there one cherry festival maybe in Sister Barry?
There is. Yep. It's actually in Jacksonport in August.
Jacksonport. Yep. in August. But spring of the year would be when are the cherry trees in full bloom?
So it varies greatly, of course, depending upon the weather. But typically it's, mid to late May is when the cherries blossom. And I got to tell you, if you've never seen a full orchard in bloom, it is something to behold. Absolutely spectacular.
It is absolutely amazing. And I bet it smells great, too.
It does smell great. I'm so fortunate that my commute to my house, I live just outside of Egg Harbor, so commuting from Sturgeon Bay to Egg Harbor, I actually drive on Reynolds Road and pass through lots of orchards. And so there are a few days in the spring that it's just divine.
The Depression had a big impact, did it not? On, well, it had an impact on many industries, and I'm guessing the cherry industry was affected in some ways.
Yes, for sure it was. And what it was a lack in labor. You know, harvesting the cherries was very labor intensive and required up to 10,000 workers just to harvest all of the cherries. And so there was a labor shortage. And then, of course, you know, during World War II, that there was an even a larger labor shortage. And so many of these orchards came up with the idea of hosting camps where they would invite, you know, teenagers to come up for the summer. They would give them a place to live and they would feed them in exchange for, you know, picking 7 buckets of cherries a day. Anything that they picked over that was their money to keep. But it was a way to kind of get groups to come in. I know Horseshoe Bay Farms did that for several years. And rumor has it that the way they enticed the teenagers to come up here was they had Green Bay Packer players as the camp counselors. Could you imagine?
You know, there's some strange stories or kind of fun stories relating to the soil. And I saw one short video, it was about 3 minutes or so long, about the dynamite orchards. And the story, you may not know this story, but there was a guy at this orchard who wanted to become the general manager. And the general, the guy who was current general manager but was going to be leaving, said, "I'll tell you what, if you, we've got 100 acres here up on this hillside. If you can plant that 100 acres full of cherry trees, in 2 years, I'll make you the general manager." And he knew a guy who knew a lot about dynamite. And they made some dynamite caps, sort of about 1 or 2 inches long. And they would dig down to the rocks, which was only about 1 foot, and then he'd take a pickaxe and make a hole, and then he'd stick one of these caps in there on a very short fuse. They'd light the fuse and then run like heck, explode, and they'd have about 2-foot-wide hole, diameter hole, and that's where they plunked down their trees. And he actually, in under 2 years, was able to plant 100 acres of cherry trees.
Oh my goodness, that's a lot of dynamite. I'm not familiar with that exact story, but I'm not surprised. And it is known that they use dynamite quite a bit to break up the rock in order to plant the orchards. If you've never been up in Door County before and put a shovel in the ground, you hit rock immediately. It's just that's what we are because we're on the escarpment. So it's not surprising that they had to use dynamite.
Yeah, I guess the guy's name was Al Erickson, and he then went on. He was made the manager of the farm, and he went on to be the manager of the farm for 43 years.
Well, that's a long time. Good for him. It's a great test. You know, if you want this job, you have to prove yourself. I kind of like the idea.
Well, you know, sort of mechanization had resulted in some big changes. Talk about that.
Definitely. So in the 60s, there was the invention of the mechanical shaker. And originally, it would just shake one limb at a time. And then it eventually was developed that it would shake the whole tree. And so this, of course, eliminated the job, the need for the 10,000 workers to handpick cherries. And they could harvest 16 trees in a minute and have the tree completely stripped of cherries. So this transformed the industry, you know, literally overnight. And the modern mechanical cherry pickers, they can harvest over 10 trees a minute today, which is crazy. But again, the harvest season is so short. They have, I think I read somewhere, 2 to 3 weeks to harvest and process all of the cherries. So, you know, orchards like Sequist up north, these huge organizations, they go constantly running 24 hours a day during this period because they have such a volume to process and to deal with. It's quite incredible.
So How are the cherries processed? I mean, cherry pie I love, and I even like. There's a cherry ice cream in my neighborhood where they make them, and they use Door County cherries. They advertise that Door County cherries. But talk about the products and where they're most used.
You come up with a food and we can figure out a way to put cherries into it. And we have cherry salsa. We have cherry jams, of course, and jellies. Dried cherries are very popular. I prefer the chocolate covered dried cherries myself. And cherry juices. You know, recently some scientific information came out talking about how healthy it is to drink cherry juice and the benefits that you receive from cherry juice. So, of course, we have cherry wine here. There's cherry beers that are brewed up here as well. Barbecue sauce. I've seen cherry honey. basically any product you can figure out how to put cherries in, because they're so delicious and they're tangy and, not super sweet. They have a little, they're a little sour, a little tart. And so they complement other flavors really well.
You failed to mention the cherry bomb.
Well, I was waiting for you to get to the cherry bounce.
Cherry bombs and cherry bounce.
Cherry bounce.
I brought back, I forget how many pails of cherries I brought back for some friends who wanted to make cherry bounce. And so then they presented me with a quart of cherry bounce.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could explain what's a cherry bounce.
So cherry bounce is essentially you take cherries and infuse them in brandy or whiskey. And then people have all different recipes for it up here, and they put in different ingredients, whether that's, cinnamon and honey and cloves and vanilla, anything that you want to add to your cherry bounce. And there's actually competitions to develop the best cherry bounce. But it becomes a very highly alcoholic beverage that you just want to sip slowly.
I can speak from experience on that one. You don't put a half a dozen of those in a drink and gobble them down.
Yeah. It's actually quite delicious over ice cream as well.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. Mine was made with brandy, and I'm not sure what else they used, but they were delicious.
Yes,
but
makes it a little dangerous.
You did not want to just gobble down two or three or four of those.
No.
And then the cherry bomb is just a cherry. That's a drink. Essentially, it's some brandy and you put cherries in. And
sure. It seems like every restaurant or bar in Door County has some version of a cherry drink, whether it's a cherry mule or, cherry lemonade. They put cherries in everything.
Cassandra emailed us with a comment. She said, tart cherry capsules relieve some of my stiffness.
Uh-huh. I have heard that it helps with arthritis. I haven't seen cherry capsules. I'm not sure what that is. Sounds like maybe just a more concentrated way to take it without having to drink a lot of juice.
Yeah, that's probably it. Karen from Heartland emailed us. Back in the 50s, when she was a child, her parents brought frozen cherries from Door County, which were sold in the local small-town grocery store, and her mom would can them in quart jars with sugar and make cherry sauce, which the family enjoyed all year long. Mom also made cherry preserves, which were delicious on homemade bread and real butter.
Sounds great.
And if I hadn't just been eating minutes ago out of five different types of ice cream, I'd probably be a little hungry for that right now. Oh, my gosh. Well, the other ones, there's cookies.
Sure.
With cherries in them. And I'm trying to, is that like an oatmeal cookie?
It's possible. I'm sure there are several recipes with cherries in cookies. And actually, the Door County Destination Door County website has a whole section dedicated to cherries, and I know they have a bunch of recipes on there as well. So that would be something people could check out if they're looking for, you know, a recipe with cherries that isn't standard and a little different.
In your mind, what's the best way to enjoy a Door County cherry?
Right out of the pail.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you're outside, if you're outside, then you've got to have you probably shouldn't be spitting the seed out, but I think you're right.
Well, it depends on where you are. There actually is a restaurant up here that does cherry spitting contests. spitting contests as well. So,
if somebody's thinking about visiting Door County this summer, how do they get a little history into their vacation?
That's a great question. We are really excited. We have just launched a Heritage Trail program, which is an online program that you can get a shortcut on your phone for. And it's a map of all the heritage and historic related sites throughout Door County. There's easily 30 of them and more being added every day. What's great about this program is that it tells you a little bit about each site and tells you how to get there. And then once you're there, it automatically assigns you some points and you can collect points for prizes. So it's kind of a fun way to get the family involved and to visit different historic sites, Eagle Bluff Lighthouse or the Noble House in Fish Creek. There's so many areas in Door County that can teach you about our history, which is fascinating and I think very unique to Door County. And this Heritage Trail is just a great way to do that. So you could go to destinationdoorcounty.com and there's information about the Heritage Trail there and put it on your phone. So when you come and visit, you're all set.
I've spent so much time in Door County, I've probably done most of that trail, but I've got to go online. What is it again? How do you get to that?
Destination Door County is, you know, our main visitor center, and they're really the best resource to go to if somebody wants to visit here, because they have everything curated on their website very nicely. So if you go to that website and do a search for a Heritage Trail, you can find the information there.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to take a look and see which ones I've missed. I've spent a lot of time in Door County.
That's great. It's a great place to be.
I think I played every golf course in Door County, too. speaking of which, the orchard is one where there's apples and cherry trees along the course, which are there, I found, for the picking as you play along. So.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, yeah. Nobody was looking, so.
there also is a golf course called Cherry Hills that you kind of go in between orchards as well, but I don't think they would like you picking their cherries.
Oh, no, this is right on the course, and they were falling off, and I just grabbed one and ate it. And Madeline in Oneida, we'll just, on the way out here, we'll get a comment from Madeline. Hi, Madeline.
Hello. I wanted to say that a lot of Indian tribes, especially the Oneidas, supplemented their income by going up and picking cherries in Door County.
Yeah, and you probably know a little about that history. Thank you, Madeline. Comment, Amy?
Absolutely. They, you know, during that kind of labor shortage, they would bring up workers from Texas, from the Bahamas, from Mexico to come and help with the crops. And I know that there were some indigenous peoples that were involved in that as well. And then interesting, in 1945, there were 2,000 German prisoners of war that came to Door County to work in the orchards for that season.
Yeah, that was another interesting fact that I forgot about it. I'm glad you brought it. There's a lot of history we didn't get to today, Amy. I'm pretty sure of that.
You know, it's hard to pack it all into 30 minutes.
Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really, really appreciate it. Amy
Happy
Frank.
Happy to do so. Let us know when you're here next.
August 10th.
All right. Sounds great.
Oh, thanks, Amy. And again, go to destinationdoorcounty.com, and you're going to find that information on that heritage site and a whole lot more. want you to think a little bit about programs for the upcoming, for the Larry Mehler Show. Once in a while, we like to take a little break and talk about ideas from our listeners. So if you've got some ideas for programs for this show, I hope you'll join with us next. I'm Larry Mehler for WPR News. You know, every once in a while, and once in a great while, I guess we could say, we like to turn our attention to you and to find out from you what you would like to hear on the Larry Mehler Show. What topics should we explore? What deserves more in-depth coverage? What do you want to learn more about? What do you think about getting more attention on the airwaves to? What should people know about that we haven't been covering, or maybe we've covered it but not as much as you would like to have us cover it? And so I'm asking for your help here. Give us some topics. If you got a special topic that you think needs to be covered, I hope you'll join in. And as well, if you can suggest a guest or guests. So topic and guests would be most useful. Otherwise, you're going to have to sit here and listen to me talk for a half hour. And I suppose that'd be all right, but I might run out of things to say that I'd have to sing or do something just to fill the time. And believe me, you probably wouldn't want to hear that. The number to call with your topic ideas is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email me, and the email address is talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Just a look ahead. Our next book club meeting is coming up. We'll talk about a novel. It's titled The Business Trip. The Business Trip by Jesse Garcia. We'll talk with her about it's a really cool novel about two strangers who meet on a plane, and mystery happens. That's our next book club. And that's August 21st. So you've got plenty of time to read it. It's called, the title is The Business Trip. And of course, Jesse Garcia from Milwaukee is the author of that book. Thursday, we're going to be talking about septic system care. Take your questions along that. And we'll talk about poison management that day. Garden Talk this week. Bruce Spangenberg is back to answer any and all of your gardening questions. Might be annuals, perennials, veggies, or something else. And then we'll talk about growing orchids for a flower show with a person who has done really well growing orchids right here from Wisconsin. And then we'll be talking on, Big Top Chautauqua Show, Riding the Wind, and you'll hear some professional puppeteers. That's next Monday. Bill Stork, our veterinarian, Dr. Bill, comes back on July 22nd to talk about virtual pet care. And we'll talk about about how service animals are trained as well. So those are some of the things coming up, and I see we have some callers online, and I've got to get my pen ready. And let's turn to Carol in Appleton. Carol, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. I have a question about immigration, which is, it seems to not be solved from the top down. It gets postponed because of election year cycles. Every 2 years, everybody runs on the topic. But it is a kind of a mess, and the immigration process is very confusing because when you sign up, how long it takes, how many years, how many levels of bureaucracy you have to go to, and then what steps you have to follow after that, so that when people are trying to do the legal process, how long it takes is something which I don't think we've really gotten into, because it becomes a more emotional yes or no, too many, too few kind of discussion, who should we accept and so on. But the actual process, I think, is totally unknown to most of the public, including myself. I would really welcome someone who can describe this in detail, all the various facets of the procedure.
Yeah, to kind of take in the politics out of it, what are the rules, and right. How do you go exactly. about it? Yeah, right. that makes
sometimes
sense.
Sometimes people are waiting for like 15 years, and they're still on the list, and they're working and doing everything right, but it takes so long. It's just crazy.
Carol, thanks. I've written this down, and I think we've got other people, hopefully, who can write more legibly than I write to help this process along. Thank you, Carol. Appreciate it. Let's go to Casey in Egg Harbor. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Larry. Good to talk with you.
Good talking with you. What have you got for us today?
Well, it's the ninth year for the Door Kinetic Arts Festival, and it takes place mostly at Bjorklunden on the Bailey's Harbor side. And it's a entertainment, film, movement, dance festival that Eric Simonson started. And next year will be the 10th anniversary, but people should come this year.
And when is it?
It's September 21st through the 28th this year. And the DKAF, will get them to the information and the schedule. And there's things happening in the evening. There's cocktails by Robert Simonson, who's written for the New York Times and done a number of cocktail books. Eric and Robert are brothers. And they'd be a great show for you.
Casey, thank you very much. And it's DAKAF, did you say?
No, DKAF.
Oh.
Door Kinetic Arts Festival.
That makes more sense. Thank you very much, Casey. Appreciate your call. Wow, another interesting. How did I not know about this? Let's go to Brad in Sun Prairie. Your turn. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. I think it'd be good to look at critical thought and valid logic in the face of growing propaganda, both from corporations and our government. Years ago, we went through the Enlightenment, and we learned how to reason, but it seems like a lot of people have forgotten this. And we end up arguing back and forth and not really understand what we're saying. So what do you think?
I see what you're saying, and it's something actually. Every time Bassam Shakashiri is on the program, he makes a case for this, Brad. Critical thought, valid logic, and he also makes the case about lowering the heat and the temperature, and listening, respectful listening as well. So I see your point, and I've written it down, and we'll see what we can do about it. Thank you very much for your suggestion, and we'll move to Jim in Oconomowoc. Jim, hi.
Hi. My suggestion is a discussion of driverless vehicles and the responsibility for them when something goes wrong and they, for example, hit a kid in a crosswalk. My wife has been a crossing guard at an elementary school for years, and she's had weekly near misses. But if she or one of the kids were to get hit, the driver would likely spend some time behind bars. Now, what happens if a driverless vehicle hits that kid? Who goes to jail under current law, and which direction are our lawmakers taking it? Should it be the owner of the vehicle, the person who sent that vehicle on its mission? If it's owned by a corporation, should the CEO of that corporation be ultimately responsible legally and have his hide on the hook. I'd like to hear a discussion of that.
Jim, thank you very much. One of the things, you know, one of the types of shows that we have is we'll have a lawyer on, and we'll talk about a variety of things, but we'll zero in on a topic each time, or maybe two or three topics each time. And I can see where that could be something that one of our attorneys that we have, I'm thinking of one of our attorneys in particular who handles actually cases sort of like this, might be able to talk about when he's next on the show. And I'm suddenly blanked on his name, but I'll come up with it. Mike is his first name, and I'm just blanking. I'm sorry. But I have it down, Jim, and it's something we can certainly bring up as part of the conversation. Thank you for your suggestion. Liz in Madison, your turn. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Larry. My idea is to have Dr. Richie Davidson of the Healthy Minds Innovation Project at the UW, and for him to talk about, and this is just an idea, but something that has to do with our youth and how I know that I use his app regularly, and he has an app specifically for young people. But with what's going on in our current climate, there's just so many topics you can choose from, whether it's climate change or current culture, politics, music, movies, whatever, and how his program, his Healthy Minds Innovation Program, and sort of practices that youth can use to manage loneliness, depression, anxiety, this sort of thing, because so many of our youth are plagued with that. And let's give them, a pill. Let's put all the pressure on their teachers who are trying to teach them a subject.
Mm-hmm.
There's just all of these different things. And so maybe putting like the driver's seat in some of these young people, like they can kind of take control of their own sort of issues and then give adults the tools to help them which to do that with. So just kind of an idea like that.
Is his app, do you know Dr. Richie Davidson's app, what the title is? Is it
Minds.
Healthy Minds. Healthy Minds
yes,
Project.
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah, it's the Healthy Minds Project. And I actually met one of the people from the Center for Healthy Minds, Tony Chambers, at a get together for a library staff, in which I am a library staff person, and they put on a program where I met Tony Chambers, and I exchanged his email, and I thought, oh, neat, so yeah, there's a number of people. Maybe you can't get Richie Davidson, Dr. Davidson there, but there are so many people that work at Healthy Minds Innovations, and I'm sure they'd be wonderful to come on and discuss some of those things for our youth, and not just the youth, but all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think, Richie Davidson, Dr. Richie Davidson, I don't know, we might be able to get him on or at least one of his reps. I think it's a good topic, and we'll follow through on it, Liz. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it very much. Just taking your program ideas today, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Great to have you listening in today. Larry Mueller here, taking your ideas for programs for this 11 to 1 o'clock time slot. If you listen to the program from time to time or maybe every day, you have an idea of the kinds of shows we do. What do you think we could add along those lines to make it even better? Kurt in Green Bay, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I absolutely love your show.
Thank you.
I would like to have you possibly get a hold of somebody from the Shawano Folk Music Festival, which is the second weekend in August. They have crafters. They have four stages of live music. It's just a really good family-friendly thing the whole weekend, and they've been putting it on for a lot of years. And I think that would make good topic for the show.
What's the and where is it? The Shawano Folk Music
Festival? This is in Shawano Folk Music Festival. It's at the Milky Theater Grounds. Usually it's the second weekend of August.
Oh, Shawano. I thought you said Sauna. Sauna, and I was thinking...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. That's just my hearing. Shawano. Okay. Shawano Folk Music Festival. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Kurt. Corey and Judah, your turn. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. My idea is to have a piece on the film culture here in Wisconsin. There are quite a few really interesting film festivals. I know the state legislature has been working on a task in trying to draw filmmakers to Wisconsin. But in particular, I was thinking it would be really fun to do something on the 48-hour film festival in Wisconsin. And that's an amateur film festival in which they're given some topics and they have 48 hours to shoot, and create this film, and they turn them in. It's really, really fun. I've been to a few of them. It's just a blast.
Did you participate yourself, or were you an observer?
I was just an observer.
You know, that sounds like a lot of fun. You got 48 hours to do the whole thing. And
48 hours.
Where does it take place?
There's one right here in Madison. I say right here because I'm only about 45 minutes from there, but one in Madison. I think there's one in Milwaukee, and I believe there's another one. I'm not sure, a little further north. But I know the Madison one is very active, and I could give you a name of someone to contact there, too, if you're interested.
Yeah, do you have a name? Give me a name.
Yep, it's Michael Keeney.
Michael Keeney. Name's familiar.
The last name, K-E-E-N-E-Y.
N-E-Y. And he's in, I'm sure I'll be able to find, we'd be able to find
he's
him.
He's in the Madison area, yep, and he is one of the organizers.
All right. Corey, thank you. Got it down. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Jerry in Appleton. Jerry, hi.
Hey, Larry. Good noon. Let me answer your question on that. I have a different question here, but a fellow called in about the folk festival in Shawano.
Yeah.
And a contact person for you would be Joel Kroenke, K-R-O-E-N-K-E. He's a big part of that. It's a really good festival. It really is. So whoever called you in Green Bay is right. It's a good festival. And it's 8, 9, and 10 of August.
8, 9, and 10.
Yeah. Very good. Very good, very enjoyable. My question, though, Larry, is I'm reading a book by David Thoreau, P-R-E-U-E-R, and it's the Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. He himself is a Native American, Princeton, and now he's teaching at U of Southern California. A great book on the beginning and the journey of the Native American. And I wonder if a topic could be worked together to get an answer to the current economic conditions of of tribal members on Indian reservations in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Just exactly what is their current economic
status
situation, and I do know there are several issues regarding fentanyl, et cetera. It seems to be a heavier burden on them. But I just think it might be something that you can get that together. That might be interesting.
Yeah. Jerry, thank you very much. Kind of a couple of different topics with the book, but also then the second on just looking at Wisconsin, Native tribes in Wisconsin and current challenges and economically and otherwise. Thank you. Appreciate it. Bruce in Wausau, we'll go to you. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, Larry. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And you got a show idea for us, I bet.
I've got a couple, actually. To piggyback on that last caller right there, I think it would be interesting to hear about current archaeological activity efforts surrounding Native culture historically in Wisconsin. Like, what's going on right now on an archaeology front? And if not Native Americans, I think I'm always intrigued by Great Lake shipwrecks, too.
Yeah, I am, too. For that. And you had another one, too.
Yeah, so the other one, just to totally change it up on you, I know WPR doesn't do much with sports usually, but in January we lost a legend in Wisconsin, Bob Uecker. I think it would be really cool to have a life and legacy of Bob Uecker. And maybe for guests there, you could maybe reach out to some of his partners, Jeff Levering, Lane Grindle, maybe Brian Anderson on the TV side. Maybe Wayne or Matt, who does the Badgers stuff?
I know Matt LePay.
Matt LePay. Yeah, just somebody like that to talk about Uecker's impact, because he was in it, well, we all know, for a long, long time. And I know growing up as a kid, it was a big part of my childhood, and I think that'd be really cool.
Yeah. We try at least once a month to do a sports-related show. And Bob's been mentioned a time or two on the show, but it would be kind of fun to maybe mix in some of his pieces from when he was on the Johnny Carson show or one of his get up, get out of here calls on a home run. It'd be kind of – and then mix in – Lane Grindle, as an example, or LePay, or any of the other guys that and gals that worked with him. I know that would be a fun show for me to do, because I spent many, many hundreds of hours over my lifetime listening to Bob Uecker on the radio. Bruce, thank you. Nancy in Verona? What's on your mind?
Right. Yes, I'd like to suggest a child care program that was, you know, with some regularity, or they're once a week or once every 2 weeks, whether you're a parent or a grandparent or a child care provider. I think it'd be great to have insights on problems as basic as how to settle a child for sleep and, you know, yeah. You know, eating nutritiously, just a child care, whether you're a parent, grandparent, or in-home provider or whatever. I think it would be a great forum for people who are interested in doing the best for their children in their lives.
Nice idea. Thank you, Nancy. Very much appreciate the idea and the comment. And here we are. Already out of time, and I see we've gotten a bunch of emails, and I'm hoping if you're not going to get on today anymore, but wpr.org/Larry, or send us an email, and include the information, and if you can, the topic, and if you can, suggest a guest, and that would be really helpful to us. This is always fun for me to do. We don't do it often enough. We ought to do it more, and we will try to do it a bit more. And I want to thank everybody we a great team. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, of course, is Jill Nadeau. We have so much fun doing this show every day. We learn a lot. I hope you learn a lot, but we also like to have fun. And I hope you had a lot of fun today, and I hope you have a lot of fun every time you tune it in. And I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.